for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support. Now.
For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I resigned from the State Department after 18 years of dedicated service because President Biden's Gaza policy was untenable.
Meet Hala Rarit, the first State Department diplomat to resign over the war in Gaza. She joins us in her first TV interview. Then Israel's assault has annihilated the healthcare system in Gaza.
We're here in the hospital in Gaza. We've been working endlessly for the last 4 or 5 days. This is the emergency department at European Gaza Hospital. What I think people are forgetting is the numerous deaths, the sickness, the morbidity, the mortality because of the, not directly because of the bombings and the conflict, but because of the lack of access to healthcare.
We'll speak with two doctors just back from the largest functioning hospital remaining in Gaza. And a historic case against U.S. military contractor CACI brought by three Iraqi survivors of torture at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq has ended in mistrial. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's killed at least 26 people in Gaza over the past day. An airstrike on a home in Rafah killed at least 6 Palestinians, 4 of them children. This is Sana Zaroub, the child's aunt.
3 missiles hit the innocent children. A mother and 2 girls were sleeping in her lap. They were sleeping in her lap. The 2 girls, do you know what it means to be sleeping in their mother's lap? They are in pieces. They were in grade 1 and grade 6. Bisan and Basmala. Bisan and Basmala were sleeping in their mother's lap. They are in pieces. They slept in their mother's lap and now they are in pieces. How did the Israelis benefit from this? What did they benefit from killing the innocent children?
Israel's refused to retreat from its threat of an expected ground invasion of Rafah, despite warnings it would be absolutely catastrophic. In other news from Gaza, Israeli authorities confirmed a prominent Palestinian doctor died in an Israeli prison in what Palestinian authorities are calling an assassination. Adnan Elbush, a surgeon, the head of orthopedics at Al-Shifa Hospital, was detained by Israel over 4 months ago while he'd been working at Al-Auda Hospital in North Gaza. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese said in response to Elbush's death, quote, "How many more lives will have to be taken before UN member states act to protect the Palestinians?" she asked. On Thursday, Israeli prison authorities released 64 Palestinians they detained in Gaza. One of the detainees was returned dead, another in critical condition. This is Jamal Oisi, one of the released prisoners, describing his arrest.
I took my children and we were leaving the area and we were going towards a safer place, such as Deir al-Bala, Khan Yunis, Mawasi, Rafah. I wanted them to be in a safe place, but they left without me. The Israeli soldiers caught me and they put me in a house. They asked me to take off all my clothes and I stayed in my underwear. Then they brought a truck and put us inside the truck. They started to beat us. They were beating me in my face. We reached the detention area, hoping they would stop beating, but they didn't.
International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan is warning the court's, quote, independence and impartiality are undermined when individuals threaten to retaliate, unquote, after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called news of possible ICC arrest warrants against himself and other top Israeli officials a, quote, anti-Semitic hate crime. As the genocide in Gaza continues, the student protest movement here in the U.S. keeps growing. The Associated Press reports nearly 2,200 people have now been arrested nationwide across college and university campuses. President Biden addressed the protests Thursday.
Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education. Look, it's basically a matter of fairness. It's a matter of what's right. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos.
President Biden also said the historic student uprising will not affect U.S. policy in the Middle East. On Thursday, police arrested students at Portland State University, the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, and here in New York, SUNY's Purchase and New Paltz campuses. Meanwhile, new solidarity encampments went up in recent days at the University of Washington, University of Toronto, among others. Video of Dartmouth College history professor Annalise Orlek being violently arrested Wednesday night has prompted outrage. Orlek, who is also chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth, was trying to protect students along with other faculty members as they were attacked by police. Police made over 90 arrests there that night. Here in New York, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office says it's investigating after a police officer fired a gunshot on the Columbia campus while the NYPD was forcing out protesters on Tuesday night from Hamilton Hall. No one was harmed in the shooting. Students at Rutgers University in New Jersey and the University of Minnesota have voluntarily disassembled their encampments after school leadership agreed to some of their demands and to continue conversations with the protesters. International solidarity encampments are also spreading, including in Italy, Australia, Mexico, and Tunisia. In France, students at the prestigious Sciences Po escalated their protest after the school rejected demands to review its relationship with Israel. Several students announced they're starting a hunger strike.
The student will continue her hunger strike until the following demand is met by Sciences Po: the inscription on its agenda and the holding of a vote without anonymity at the council of the institute to investigate the ties with Israeli universities who are contributing to the genocide.
The Pentagon has acknowledged that a U.S. drone strike in Syria, which was initially reported to have successfully targeted an al-Qaeda senior leader, in fact, killed a farmer. The strike took place last May, killing Lutfi Hassan Masto, a 56-year-old farmer who raised sheep, chickens, and cattle. After the attack, Masto's family and neighbors said he had no connections to al-Qaeda or any other armed groups. Russian armed forces may have executed Ukrainian soldiers who attempted to surrender or had already surrendered, which could amount to war crimes. That's according to a new report published by Human Rights Watch, which investigated incidents of what it described as apparent summary executions of at least 15 Ukrainian soldiers between December 2023 and February. In related news, the Biden administration has imposed new sanctions against hundreds of individuals and firms linked to Russia's war in Ukraine after accusing Moscow of illegally deploying chemical weapons against Ukrainian fighters. The sanctions include 20 firms based in China and Hong Kong. In Virginia, the historic case against U.S. military contractor CACI, brought by three Iraqi survivors of torture at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, has ended in mistrial after the jury on Thursday failed to reach a unanimous verdict. The lawsuit against CACI was first filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights in 2008. Plaintiffs Suhail al-Shamari, Asad Zubai, and Salah al-Ajali had accused CACI of conspiring to commit war crimes at Abu Ghraib. The three were subjected to sexual abuse and other forms of torture by interrogators. We'll have more on the story later in the broadcast with the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. The Biden administration announced a new rule expanding access to the Affordable Care Act for immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, known as Dreamers. The measure will allow recipients of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, to enroll in health care plans under Obamacare. Some 100,000 immigrants are expected to enroll. The Senate Budget Committee held a hearing this week on the fossil fuel industry's efforts to deceive the public about its role in fueling the climate crisis. Wednesday's hearing focused on what lawmakers identified as the fourth phase in Big Oil's climate deception, in which companies launched a widespread greenwashing campaign as they carried out business as usual. This is Senate Budget Committee Chair Sheldon Whitehouse.
Phase four, put simply, is climate denial light, a green-leaning cover for the industry's continued covert operation through dark money, phony front groups, false economics, and relentless exertion of political influence to block meaningful climate safety progress.
A federal court of appeals has sided with the Justice Department and dismissed Giuliana versus United States, the historic youth climate lawsuit against the U.S. government. The decision was made by a panel of three Trump-appointed judges from the Ninth Circuit. The group who brought the case, Our Children's Trust, is calling on the full court to reconsider the ruling and on the American public to contact the Biden administration to demand it stop persecuting climate activism. Kelsey Giuliana, the named plaintiff in the case, spoke to Democracy Now! In 2019.
So we're looking at the ways that the federal government has very knowingly and willfully funded this climate crisis, and the way that they are continuing to stall and delay our climate case shows you exactly their priorities of their own self-interest and continuing this greedy fossil fuel economy rather than ensuring national rights of life, liberty, and property to all citizens, especially young.
The UK has started rounding up and detaining asylum seekers as part of its highly contested plan to deport migrants to Rwanda. Rights groups are hoping legal challenges can stop the deportation flights, which are expected to start as early as July. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Conservative government overrode a Supreme Court ruling in order to ram through the policy. On Thursday, London police arrested dozens of protesters who lay down on the road and slashed tires to stop a bus from carrying detainees to a barge that was converted into a migrant prison. Authorities were forced to postpone the planned transfer of asylum seekers. Two Trump-appointed federal judges rejected a new Louisiana congressional map, which created a second majority black district. The map was drawn up after another federal judge ruled a previous voting map, which had just one black majority district, violated the Voting Rights Act. Roughly one-third of Louisiana's population is black. It remains unclear which map Louisiana will be using in November as the case is expected to reach the U.S. Supreme Court. In other election news, New York Democratic State Senator Timothy Kennedy easily won a special election Tuesday for the New York congressional seat vacated in February by Brian Higgins, another Democrat. House Republicans hold 217 seats, while Democrats have 213 seats with five current vacancies. In New York, prosecutors told a judge at the Manhattan Criminal Court they will retry Harvey Weinstein after the New York Court of Appeals overturned his 2020 rape conviction last week. The new trial is expected sometime after Labor Day. And today marks World Press Freedom Day. UNESCO awarded its World Press Freedom Prize to all Palestinian journalists covering Israel's war on Gaza. During a ceremony in Chile, the jury's chairperson, Mauricio Weibel, said, quote, "As humanity, we have a huge debt to their courage and commitment to freedom of expression," he said. Palestinian authorities say over 140 journalists and media workers, the vast majority of them Palestinian, have been killed since October 7th. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's killed at least 26 Palestinians in Gaza over the past day, including at least seven people, four of them children, in an airstrike on Rafah, the southernmost city in Gaza, where over 1.4 million Palestinians have sought refuge. Nearly 35,000 Palestinians have been killed over the past nearly 7 months, with 7,000 others missing and believed to be buried under the rubble. Nearly 78,000 have been wounded. A new United Nations report called the level of casualties in Gaza unprecedented in such a short period of time. The report also said the world has not seen the level of destruction of housing in Gaza since World War II. Here in the United States, a massive student protest movement with Gaza solidarity encampments and university campuses across the country has been met with public raids, mass arrests, and violence. Nearly 2,200 people have been arrested at 43 colleges and universities in recent weeks. President Joe Biden addressed the protest Thursday for the first time in weeks in unscheduled remarks from the White House.
Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education. Look, it's basically a matter of fairness. It's a matter of what's right. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos.
As President Biden concluded his remarks, he was asked whether the student protests would prompt him to reconsider his foreign policy.
Mr. President, have the protests forced you to reconsider any of the policies with regard to the region?
No.
The Biden administration's financial, military, and diplomatic backing of Israel's assault on Gaza has sparked dissent within the U.S. government with resignations and walkouts by government employees. Today, we're joined by the first State Department diplomat to publicly resign over the war on Gaza. Hala Rarit is an 18-year career diplomat who recently resigned from the State Department. She's the third State Department employee, but the first Foreign Service officer to do so. Hala Rarit served as the Arabic language spokesperson for the State Department in the region. She joins us now in her first TV interview since her resignation. Hala Rarit, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you so much, Amy. It's an honor to be with you.
Can you start off by talking about why you have publicly resigned?
Absolutely. Honestly, I wasn't intending to publicly resign. I was intending to resign. My profile at the Dubai Media Hub, my last assignment, was quite high profile. My role was to speak to Arab media about American policy. So it inevitably made the news when I did resign. It first made the news, I believe, here in the region and in the United States. But the reason why I resigned is really because I could no longer be a part of the State Department and promote this policy. It's an inhumane policy. It's a failed policy that is helping neither Palestinians, neither Israelis. And I want to stress that point, that it's not strictly the horrific mass killings that we have all been watching over the course of over 200 days, the targeting of journalists, of healthcare workers, over 14,000 children massacred. But it's also not keeping Israelis any safer. The hostages are still in Gaza. Israelis know that there's going to be a vicious cycle of violence after so many have been killed in Gaza. This does not help anyone. And the militaristic policy is not the solution. As a diplomat, as someone that believes in diplomacy, in the power of diplomacy, I did everything I could from within to try to explain this on a daily basis, through reports, through cables. Nothing was working until finally I made the decision that I could no longer be part of the system.
What do you feel President Biden and your boss at the State Department, Secretary of State Tony Blinken, could do right now that would be most effective?
They need to abide by national, domestic law and international law. We have systems in place within the State Department to ensure situations like this don't happen. We are not authorized to send military equipment, weapons, to countries that commit human rights abuses. ICJ has determined plausible genocide, yet we are still sending billions upon billions of not just defensive weaponry, but offensive weaponry. It is tantamount to a violation of domestic law. Many diplomats know it. Many diplomats are scared to say it. It's a violation of international law, what we've been seeing happening in Gaza. And we cannot make exceptions for our allies. It does not help our allies to make exceptions. Because again, all that this is doing is creating a vicious cycle of violence. And it has clearly failed. Its objectives, it has failed. The hostages are still not back families where they belong. The situation in Gaza remains intensely unstable. People continue to suffer on a daily basis. It's time for President Biden and Secretary Blinken to realize that this militaristic approach has been a failure, and they need to stop. They need to abide by U.S. law, And that doing so will create a lot of leverage. If we are able to condition military aid, we will be able to pressure Israel. We will also be able to work with our Arab allies to pressure Hamas to have real substantive change on the ground. That's what's necessary at this time, not more arms.
Why do you think President Biden does not do that? As he says, he's heartbroken by the number of casualties, and he says he admonishes the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Clearly, the arms flow continues. Washington Post, New York Times reporting on, the well over 100 arms transfers that are made or arms sales just under the threshold that would require Congress to approve it.
Absolutely. You make a very good point, Eamon. Right under the threshold, willfully enabling the crimes that are happening in Gaza. And that's why I could no longer be part of the State Department, because it's willful. It's a very difficult answer to give you. And it's one question that I ask myself every single day. Why doesn't President Biden act? Why doesn't Secretary Blinken act? If I had the answer to that, perhaps I'd be somewhere else right now. I'd be within the system still trying to affect change. But the bottom line to me, and what it appeared like to me from within the system, and also as a spokesperson who was reading the talking points, is that fundamentally an Israeli life was not worth, or Palestinian life was not worth the same as an Israeli life. And it's heartbreaking for me to say that as someone that has proudly served my country for 18 years. But I read the talking points that we were supposed to promote on Arab media. A lot of them were dehumanizing to Palestinians. 34,000 people killed in Gaza right now, and we're still insisting that this is the only option when it's not. Also, as a diplomat, I could not help but be concerned about the influence of special interest, of the arms lobby, of other special interests that serve foreign governments. It is very, very frustrating when you're working on a daily basis on American foreign policy, but you know that no matter what you do and no matter what very senior officials in the department are doing, and despite all of the recommendations going up to Washington from the field, policy is not changing. I could not help but be concerned about the influence of special interest groups, of lobbying groups on our foreign policy, and as well on Congress, on the people that decide whether or not some of those shipments of arms get sent. The bottom line is that our politicians should not be profiting from war. And unfortunately, we have some institutionalized corruption that enables that. And as an American diplomat, my concern was U.S. national security interest. And I protested against this, but unfortunately could not affect enough change that I had to submit my resignation.
You mentioned institutionalized corruption. Can you explain that further, Hala?
It is public knowledge that our politicians are able to profit significantly from the arms industry, from campaign contributions. That is something that is never allowed for a diplomat. We have no ability to gain any financial gain from anything, really. Everything has to be very transparent for us. We obviously have secret, top secret security clearances. Our lives are really open book when we're a diplomat. And that's how it should be, because we're serving our country. We're not serving ourselves. We're serving the people of the United States. We're implementing the laws of the land, and it should be for the sake of U.S. national security, not for personal gain, not for campaign contributions. And as a diplomat, it was very concerning to me knowing that our domestic system clearly has an influence on our foreign policy, because we were not being heard.
I wanted to ask you about how the administration, to the highest levels, Blinken and, of course, ultimately Biden, respond to criticism and how much they hear. The latest news, among a lot of other reports, more than 250 former staffers in the Obama administration and campaign workers for the Obama-Biden ticket sent a letter to their former bosses demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and calling for the U.S. to end its staunch support for Israel. Israel. You then have the number of people who've resigned publicly and more privately. I'm wondering their response to you. But have you spoken directly with President Biden, with Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, your, well, previous boss?
Did you ask, Amy, if I've spoken to them directly?
Yes.
I have not spoken to them directly. I mean, not in this particular occasion. I have in the past for Secretary Blinken, but not for this particular occasion. But what we do as diplomats is we send reporting. We send information back. That's why we are overseas in our embassies and our consulates. And our job is to try to help Washington in making informed decisions. We do that. And we do hear from Secretary Blinken. We do hear about a culture of we want to hear about dissent. We want to hear critical feedback. I can tell you that for me, it was a mixed bag. I provided that critical feedback. I provided daily reports, for example, showing what Pan Arab Media was covering in terms of the Gaza crisis, showing how there was growing anti-Americanism. Every single day I could see growing anti-Americanism, which was extremely concerning. And I was trying to raise this on a daily basis to Washington, explaining we need to change course. This is hurting our own national security interest if we maintain this policy. I was met with silencing. I was met with being sidelined. I was also met with, thank you for your critical feedback. This is going to the highest levels of our government. We need more of this. I was met with more silencing, more sidelining. So for me, it was really a mixed bag. And I have to be honest that there were people that were trying to ensure that those messages were heard. But at the end of the day, and what was the most frustrating is that in particular, with my particular role as Arabic spokesperson, I explained that our messaging posture was hurting more so than helping us. Yet our messaging posture never has changed. We're still using the talking points directed to the Arab world, even if it's inflaming the tensions, even if it's instigating people across the region, even if it's making people across the region hate us more and be more frustrated with us because they hear the double standard. They hear the double standard when we condemn an attack on Israeli interests, but we don't condemn the Palestinians, only show concern. They're very, very in tune with these double standards, and it hurt us to continue to amplify these talking points. And it was very frustrating for me that there was the continued expectation that we would do that, despite all of the data, despite the clear proof that it's not helping America, it's hurting America.
You refused to comment. You were the Arabic language spokesperson to the Arab world. You refused to comment on U.S. policy in Gaza. Can you explain why you made that decision?
Absolutely. Just as I mentioned right now, I made it abundantly clear through daily reports of the ramifications of our messaging. Abundantly clear. I showed every day what was happening, what the reaction was, and I also was monitoring Arab social media and sharing with Washington the images that were viral across Arab social media. And these, thank you as well, Amy, for amplifying the voices of the Palestinian families at the top of the hour. Those are things that sometimes Washington does not hear. But it is what the Arab public is consuming on a daily basis. And these pictures of dead children, of maimed toddlers, they're traumatizing. And my point back was, look at these images that people in this part of the world are consuming on a daily basis. There is an absolute disconnect with what people in the Arab world are seeing happening in Gaza and our talking points. There's an utter disconnect, and it does not serve our interest to continue pretending like what's happening in Gaza is not happening, and we keep promoting things that are just instigating. So my role was to be a spokesperson, but I also believe my role to be to serve the United States, to advance American interests, to have effective messaging, not just messaging. And I could not in good conscience do something and go out on Arab TV knowing that it was hurting my country, doing that, not helping it.
Explain more specifically, because this is a serious, important critique and charge, that the president, that the Secretary of State are actually endangering U.S. national security with the position and the support of Israel that they are taking right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we had three of our troops killed in Jordan. That was in direct reaction to our Israel policy. And when that happened, I said, again, I will not be part of this. And then if an attack happens on American interests in the region,